How much Bitcoin do you think you need to retire going forward?
90% odds this thing can't be below $1 million next year. Like those, I don't know, there's versions of that kind of risk on behavior that.
Do you kind of foresee like another giant run up then here for like 2025?
The riskiest thing at all ever is to presume there's no risk.
Do you think that the halving is going to continue to help drive like these giant waves, or do you think it's more of like a business cycle because we're in kind of still this fiat state?
What you got to experience in the 2020 and 21 cycle, what I felt kind of real time there was something like the Cantillon effect.
Bing bong. I am live here at Pleb Lab down in Austin, Texas with Joe Kelly, the CEO of Unchained. But Joe, there's a very hot topic going on right now in the world of Bitcoin, especially with the price action running to where it is. And as Unchained is a big IRA provider for Bitcoin, how much Bitcoin do you think you need to retire going forward?
Oh, great debate. We have a calculator for this on our website. A lot depends on certain assumptions and comfort levels. I mean, I think it's probably you're sitting well if you've got at least 10, but.
So you need 10 Bitcoin to retire right now?
At least, I think. I mean, you know, I think you, money.
Yeah, it's all relative,
like
right?
They used to, or they continue to make money, but I guess, yeah, I do think, you know, I've seen people or adults and families or that people I've known that you have $1 million. That's good. That's a comfort padding for, you know, several years with a low cost life table, something, but really depends on your age, of course. That's why I like the calculator that we have on our site is actually pretty neat because of how dynamic it is. Change assumption about your age, change assumption about inflation in the future, change assumption about Bitcoin's performance or what model you want to pick for price targets like that. All that stuff kind of has to balance with each other. And that's why it's like there's no static answer.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. All right. So you've been obviously running Pleb Lab. Unchained.
Not Pleb Lab, yes.
Not Pleb Lab, but Unchained.
Nobody runs this thing.
Yeah, I know. It's a madhouse in here. But Unchained since 2016, I was looking at the price because you guys have the block height of when you guys started.
Yeah.
It was $10,800 about, I want to say. So we're sitting here at just over 100K.
Was it 10,000? Did you say? I mean, because it would have been 16 when we incorporated.
Yeah. Like, so you guys had the block height on here, and I actually pulled it up on this block height explorer, so I can get the exact price for it. Is 10,892, to be exact.
I almost want to double check our block height that we have on there, or like.
That's what it said. That's what it says here. So I'm not 100.
We incorporated in October 2016.
Yeah.
And I can't remember that Bitcoin hit 10K until 17.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm slightly wrong here. But either way, you've been through a lot of various cycles. And it was interesting when I was exploring your site 2 years ago, you're like, well, hey, you were basically like wrote a long article on Unchained about basically everybody stay calm because there's a lot of turbulence in the market at this time.
Yeah.
So do you feel a little vindicated now that we're seeing the price kind of run up? And like, how are you looking at everything? Because last, you know, bull run, we saw a lot of craziness. So how are you kind of preparing for that going forward?
Yeah, it's definitely a good time. It feels like kind of summer for the industry. You know, things are bright. It's a time of harvesting almost in terms of like firms that are well positioned, firms that have good client relationships, good ability to earn more new client relationships as people enter the space for the first time. So yeah, and whether it's vindication, I mean, I think just we've stuck to Bitcoin, stuck to good Bitcoin native principles, stuck to good Bitcoin native ways to build product. We've always prioritized self-custody, working with people holding their own keys, even among cycles and for a lot of periods when like investors or just the narrative, the more popular narrative was like people aren't going to want to do that. But I think it still holds true that you know 50% of Bitcoin or thereabouts is held in self-custody. It's not with a centralized custodian, and that's just a lot of the market, and you know Chain is really well positioned to work with that population and the kind of ever-present flow of people out of centralized custody and into self-custody, so that's been a good bet for Unchained.
Yeah, so how do you see the development and the change of just like I guess the people or you know maybe the clients that are coming into Unchained like looking more into Bitcoin, because obviously we've had a lot of things change within this past calendar year. And you guys have seen massive amounts of change in the industry in the 8 years. So what has been kind of, I guess, the development of like the consumer base? Is it more, I guess, general now? Maybe now you're seeing bigger financial people kind of come in. Like what is kind of the shift that you're seeing?
That's a great question because I can say And I think for a lot of people that have been in the industry for a while too, any service provider, especially, you know, when you onboard people into products like Unchained and you get familiar with their clients and you meet them, there's real clustering. There's really different cohorts of adoption in Bitcoin. You have the kind of pre-2013 crowd, which those people, those had to have been like on the mailing list. They were like cyberpunks or cryptographers, or then they were like those people's networks, or people were, you know, making online transactions at that time. But come 2013, that's kind of when the first, I feel like, wave really hit Silicon Valley. And you had Wences from Zappo, you had like Naval, you had like a lot of people that were in the mix there, in some form of like tastemaking sense, like saying, oh, I think Bitcoin at the time, you know, unfortunately, a lot of narrative also went crept into like, I don't know about Bitcoin, how about that blockchain? At least that was like, all right, enough people, you know, really that tech crowd brought it. And I would put myself kind of in that category. I was in my first exit or a sale of a company in 2013 that led me into Bitcoin, that led me into holding it. And I was just probably part of that kind of like tech bro cohort, I guess. Then 17 is kind of that first like fresh mainstream kind of crowd. I think really pre-17, there wasn't anything near like a mania or just outside of technology, any great adoption. And by then you'd had Coinbase and other firms that had enough infrastructure and ease of onboarding experience, that like the mania of 17 was really retail driven mania. Things like we're hitting the headlines and like Ethereum and ICOs. And again, yet more a narrative, I don't know about Bitcoin, but maybe that blockchain, or maybe it's these other tokens or this world computer thing. And then the bear market of 18 and 19 came about. 2020 was remarkable in that you saw corporate treasury adoption for Bitcoin. You saw Paul Tudor Jones and other major investors singing to Bitcoin. And you started to mix in, those Wall Street folks and the general public that just started waking up to like, what is the money printer? You know, the money printer meme, like this, what is, you know, the pizza, we're all at home. There's all this COVID stimulus happening. It really caused a lot of people to research and understand, okay, what is money? What is this Bitcoin? What's the relationship between these two things? Could Bitcoin be money? They better get some. So then that's, again, a mix of, I think, more mainstream Wall Street, more mainstream just investors and Joe Public generally carried you through 20 and 21. Then there's obviously after post 22, a retreat, tied it out in a lot of folks. And yeah, now it's just it's a rekindling. It's like even further, I'd say, saturating into those audiences or those pools of interest and capital in traditional Wall Street. Now that it's kind of, all right, we're past the bleed from FTX. Interest rates have come down again. We've got a good, you know, healthy, administrative policies on the horizon for our industry. So that all feeds that cohort, plus just the price, you know, is its own news creating item that creates cycles for retail. So yeah, there's a classic probably what you could describe that like a technology adoption curve, like the early adopters into the laggards. And I don't think we're quite yet into the late adopter category, but this is definitely like the mass market time. ETFs, you know, helped out a lot too.
Yeah. So you mentioned price. Obviously, that's like a big driver, right? It's what makes the headlines, especially in like the traditional financial world. So, you know, with it crossing 100,000, do you think that that has given it more, like Bitcoin more, I guess, like validity maybe to the average person? Or is it something else that maybe has driven it, whether it's the ETFs or, you know, the talks of the strategic reserve? Like, where do you see price kind of, I guess, in this argument and creating validity for Bitcoin?
It's a mix. Like, I think, my personal view is something like the strategic reserve a couple of weeks ago, I'd have discounted to a 40% chance of happening with, you know, kind of like watching it, the chances increase daily. I think now you're at least maybe 50% or starting to get better. It's no guarantee, you know, we got to watch things happen. And I think that's something that's constantly getting priced in. And the more the market sees the evidence that this is going to happen, the more buying activity there would be. And that also the 100K price threshold that you mentioned, I mean, it is something, there's a psychological element there too. And price psychology is something, science within marketing, why we buy goods for 99 cents instead of a dollar. There's a lot there around just consumer behavior, personal psychology, psychology of money that says like a something that prices at $100,000. You know, feels quite real, and then when it trades for, you know, $92,000, man, that sounds like a good deal. You know, where a month ago, you know, from looking at 92 from 87 looks expensive, but looking at 92 from over 100 looks cheap. So,
Yeah. So do you like, do you kind of foresee like another giant run up then here for like 2025? And I don't know if I want to put you on the spot for a price prediction, but do you see like that kind of like hysteria because of how much potential FOMO money that we have on the side this time, where it's, you know, not only just retail and retail driven and, you know, FTX and all those other, you know, nefarious characters last bull run were selling paper Bitcoin. This time it's a little bit more regulated and we have, you know, nation state FOMO and the ETF FOMO for, you know, hedge funds to kind of come in. And that seems to be a little bit more regulated, but I guess you never know, right? So a few of them have released their wallet address, but not all of them.
Yeah.
So do you see this as another kind of, I guess, like bull run hysteria? But, you know, is this cycle different, I guess, is the classic question.
I suppose. I mean, I think certainly from a business planning perspective, we have to plan for there's another bear market somewhere down the road. Whether that means we're selling off from, you know, 150K Bitcoin to 75 or selling off from 250K Bitcoin down to 150. I don't know, but I think that's kind of the, at least from how we have to operate as a business and probably an industry overall, watching for things like amount of leverage that happens, whether it's in just Bitcoin that's collateral to loans or things in like other markets like futures and places where just people on the other side of price movements for Bitcoin suddenly have to sell a lot, and that's painful for everyone. So looking for that not to get too hot in the ecosystem can mean any big sell-off type markets aren't as painful or have a softer landing.
Yeah. So is there something that you're going to be looking at like pretty closely during this market where, you know, maybe it's not a definitive event that you can predict right now, but something that you're kind of tracking closely where, you know, you can be like, all right, this seems to be the top because of X hysteria, whatever it is. I mean, you mentioned derivatives, like that market is absolutely huge. But as it stands right now, people are buying four puts for every call. So right now the buying hysteria is in. If that flips, maybe that's, maybe a bearish signal. I don't know how you're looking at these things, but I'm curious to see what you, I guess, are kind of keeping a closer eye on, or if you're just kind of, you know, as as a veteran in the space, just kind of riding the waves and just, you know, going business as usual.
I think it's probably, I mean, it's a mix of things. I think it's multidimensional, right? The idea that there's not this glass ceiling of what's the government going to do about it? What about the regulatory kind of stuff? Like at least to the degree that that removes a lot of the psychological barriers to like just how high this thing could go. And it's hard. I'm a big fan of like the Howard Marks stuff that says the riskiest thing at all ever is to presume there's no risk. And so as long as everyone is market actors behaves as if, this thing could go down, you know, it's like that actually kind of creates some safety. But if it's like, as soon as everyone's like, ain't no way this thing's, you know, 90% odds this thing can't be below $1 million next year. Like those, I don't know, there's versions of that kind of risk on behavior that, you know, conversely, the second order effect is be careful. And that's where the other model is always just like the, what percentage of your Uber drivers talk about Bitcoin? What percentage of, you know, people in your common life come out of the woodwork for this, asking questions? And that's usually still decently bullish, but it starts to correlate more with those feelings of like tops. I'm less practiced and studied at watching markets. I mean, I do think one of the ways I talked about it with our head of trading is just kind of markets like what we've been in the last few weeks, they do feel, it's like, to use an airplane analogy, it's at like high altitude, you know, where like, little gusts of wind really affect the plane a lot. There's not so much like buoyancy. And so like your market structure inside of order books of both sided sell and flow volumes, it's just thin air that we're kind of on. I bet, you know, more derivatives markets, like you mentioned, there might be insight from the different puts and calls and just kind of the ratios of things that those on the other sides of those kinds of products. I don't have that up on like a dashboard or anything like that, but that's probably also a useful tool. The last one I mentioned is the, well-known HODL waves, something we helped popularize early on at Unchained. It was part of the insight for Unchained of looking at how much Bitcoin stays relatively static or is held for the long term. That's how we steer our business to work with that kind of Bitcoin ownership. Now, and you can watch in the cycles of like for the 17, mania, something in the 21 ish era mania or bull market, that like there was some percentage of Bitcoin that got became new or young again. And now I don't watch it. It's hard. You can't watch it on like a day-to-day basis to really glean this, but probably week over week, you know, there's just some version of watching, you know, pretty, because it's held for some years now, really kind of since that 17 market, where as much as 60-65% of Bitcoin hadn't moved in a year or more. I'm betting by now that's closer now, like 60, maybe we could have gotten under 60% of Bitcoin is older than a year. And so maybe, you know, benchmarking on something like 2017, which I think got maybe almost now, like almost like only 40 to 45% of Bitcoin was a year or more older, as somewhere in there. It's just like there's some amount of Bitcoin that long-term holders are going to peel off and sell. And you're kind of just looking at like, what do you think is the place that some of that behavior maxes out at?
One of the most crooked industries, most fiat industries there is the health insurance industry. Let's be honest, you don't even need health insurance. If you could find somebody that would help you find awesome doctors, negotiate your bills, and fund those bills through a peer-to-peer funding platform, would you take it? That sounds pretty appealing to me, and that's why I've joined forces with CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is a place that you could do that all in one. One giant place, you can have a group of peers where they will help you find the best healthcare that you need. On top of all that, I can help get you a discount to get you on your feet and get everything started. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 3 months at $99. And with all of this, you will get the healthcare you need. You don't have to worry about going through to the doctor, negotiating, everything like that. Did you hit your deductible? Did you not? Is this insurance company going to cover this claim? Is it not? You don't have to worry about any of that stress. And you could just get CrowdHealth behind you, where they can help you get the number one place to have a health insurance alternative. So join the revolution. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Tell them that Green Candle sent you. And join me and the rest of the great CrowdHealth users in this peer-to-peer funding platform. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show. Yeah, now I'm curious because, you know, I kind of have this theory that as the time goes on, and maybe it's this halving, where the halving or the next halving, where it doesn't matter quite as much, and it's more on like user behavior, because we have so many psychos that are never going to sell and bring their Bitcoin to the bottom, right? And the amount that's mined, essentially, there's like 7% of the coins, or maybe even less at this point now, that are left to be mined. Yep. So I feel like the 7% left is not going to really drive the market. Do you think that the halving is going to continue to help drive like these giant waves, or do you think it's more of like a business cycle because we're in kind of still this fiat state, so to speak?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard because I really struggle to have much beyond, or I really struggle to have a concrete case about why like the actual stock flow model or view of Bitcoin in terms of like the flow of newly mined Bitcoin having a market moving effect. It certainly has a non-zero effect. I think it's almost like one of, by now, several factors that are propped up in just like a multi-causal outcome, where like, yeah, there's a change in that flow from newly minted Bitcoin that could be needing sold. There's just the narrative like shelling point around this major milestone, this well-seen, well-broadcasted thing we know is going to happen every approximately 4 years. That happens. And then there's just ways of like, almost just feels like fate, you know, right? Or that like something about these 4 year cycles, either again, because of just like the psychology gets primed for it, or like, I don't know, how would we have ever predicted that the president we're getting this year is like the Bitcoin president? Election cycles happen every 4 years kind of anyway. So like, there's just some kind of interesting way that for just a popular behavior, almost like a quantitative, like sociological kind of perspective, we're watching these 4 year cycles play out in a way that, I think it's like overdetermined. You would over allocate your reasoning on just the stock to flow thing if you didn't also treat it like a real market of just market psychology and all of our narratives with each other.
Yeah. So you mentioned Trump being like a Bitcoin president. How big of a role do you think he's going to play like going forward in this next 4 years? Mm-hmm. I know Bitcoin doesn't care, right? But mm-hmm. I think like the US kind of going into Bitcoin, the potential making the strategic reserve, you know, I think these are all like pretty monumental moments for the Bitcoin and Bitcoin space. Like, how big of a role do you think he's going to play in, I guess, just Bitcoin in general here in this next 4 years? Do you think it's bigger than Bukele, or, you know, how do you see this, like, I guess, playing out?
I mean, it's hard to, you know, hard to one up Bukele, man. I mean, I think just like that, you can't take away from somebody when they were early and brave. So, you know, Trump's moves here are, will be different in quality, but still, yet, yeah, arguably maybe potential bigger in impact, just due to the size of the U.S. market and what kind of signal, you know, a U.S. Bitcoin strategic reserve sends. So I think it'll be massive. I think, again, just back to like, how do we try to steer the business? I think I try to think about over the next 2 years. It's just like, we may have a longer bull market than we've had before, just because there's not the regulatory breaks that we've gotten in previous administrations, but also don't, I don't know, you know, it's fair to have odds that we're just in a super cycle.
Yeah.
I think also have other odds going the other way, and, you know, midterms or like there might be a rotation in the House or Senate in 2 years again. So that, like, you know, things could get stuck in the mud in the back half of their presidency. So yeah, just, I try to think about it in like the next 1 to 2 year chunks, and that this is a great, get back to the idea that it's like sun is shining. It's a great day to make hay.
Yeah.
Gather the hay, you know, feel good and make sure any of us individually and as companies can be around for the long term after.
Yeah. So you mentioned companies being around for the long term, right? So it seems like that's kind of a growing trend, at least in like the publicly traded companies, to look at what Saylor and MicroStrategy is doing to hold Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Microsoft had the vote on Tuesday of this week, 99.7, I want to say, or maybe 6.5 or something of the vote shareholders voted no.
Was that actual shareholders, or was that like by share count?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Somebody break that out. I think it would make sense to me that
it would be by share count.
That would be by share count, because then, because you just have like, yeah, big shareholders
throw their weight around, vote.
You know, yeah, have more vote. But like, I mean, just on a base rate, you know, 30% of adults own cryptocurrency, own Bitcoin.
Yeah,
like that, like just map that kind of, you know, there's not 30% of investors own Microsoft directly, but probably by proxy through like ETFs or things like that. Again,
yeah,
that's base rate. So it's just, oh, so instead of, so I would. Yeah, I haven't had the time to look and see if anybody actually.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's a good point. But then Amazon also is talking about doing that. They're telling their board to at least like investigate it as well. So do you think that this is going to be a growing trend as well, like in this next year or so, where, you know, it's not only like the nation states, the ETFs, but now businesses are going to be looking at it strictly because like shareholders are going to start to demand it?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a vibe of look what those guys are doing. Can't we do some of that?
Is this
like a thing happening right now? Let's do it. Some people weighed in. And I do think, you know, for a lot of businesses that don't have enough other things to keep them busy or enough other productive uses of capital, it is a great allocation. So yeah, I mean, the odds would be you're likely to see more, but whether we'll see like the blue chips, you know, Fortune 100s doing it, I think that could still yet take more time, or I just don't hold up my hopes.
Yeah. I'm just curious. Yeah. Because like the effect of MicroStrategy and Michael Saylor on that, like, you know, there's Michael Saylor, who's obviously a billionaire, right? But I think there's like a little bit of levels to it, right? There's him and then there's Jeff Bezos, but he's also been seen, you know, talking with Jeff Bezos, had Jeff Bezos on his yacht, and, you know, he's kind of like in the mix with that crowd, so to speak. And so it seems like that's going to be, you know, whether it's Saylor traveling to all these countries and orange pilling people, it seems like he's kind of, I guess, making a huge push for that. So, you know, the NASDAQ 100, I believe, is voting or going to vote while we're recording this, maybe about adding MicroStrategy to that indice.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the flywheel effect that he keeps bringing on, where getting more debt, you know, buying more Bitcoin, so on and so forth, I feel like it's kind of hard not to notice with what he's doing. So are you getting more, I guess, like you don't have to name specific names or anything like that, but more talks from other business owners who are curious about this strategy, whether it's private companies or public companies that are like looking at Unchained as a, you know, potential source of information or help to do something like that?
Yeah, I think business accounts, business custody, solutions is one of the growing segments for Unchained, and it's relatively less common at like the private company. I'm sorry, the public company scale.
Okay,
especially private, privately held, privately controlled businesses that are just more flexible. They don't have the shareholder vote or get big board alignment exercise ahead of them to adopt something like Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The number one way to buy and sell Bitcoin is through Unbanked. They require no KYC. And on top of that, if you sell, you get zero fees. That's right. Zero fees with that withdrawal. There's cash at over 28,000 locations. You could get this money directly to your PayPal, Venmo, or bank instantly with no wait time. And they have in-house support in the United States. If you've got any questions for them, they've been an independent company operating since 2014. So they've been a trusted brand in the industry. And on top of all this, to start off the new year, they're partnering up with me to give you a raffle that will take place January 31st. See if you could win a chance at $210. All you got to do is sign up on this app using this link below, unbanked.com/greencandle. Go there, download the app, and then on top of that, you could potentially win $210. That's a lot of sats, and it's going to be less and less sats the longer you wait, folks. So go ahead and sign up today. And enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Okay. So, well, do you think outside of like the public, like public companies needing to hold a vote, do you think that, I guess like the private companies just have more flexibility to do that? Do something like with Unchained where it's multi-sig custody, whereas like a publicly traded company needs, basically needs a custodian, more like a Coinbase or something like that? Or is there kind of like differences in the regulations like that? Because to be honest, I have no idea.
I mean, qualified custody is it's semantically relevant. It's psychologically relevant. It's not actually like legally relevant to somebody who's not managing other people's money
okay.
in general. But still, insofar as it's a class of things referred to, but that where those things are trust companies or banks, things that have a regulated license to operate. That category is, always still going to be a leading choice or the leading part of the initial checkboxes for an allocation and holding of Bitcoin in these firms. And that's one of the dangers of the space insofar as like the, winner take all of the Coinbase custody kind of being the way that you're going to see more and more of these people go to because it's the one trusted thing, so the ETFs use and stuff like that. And that is just where there's that massive honeypot risk, massive custodial pot that we're conscious of it on chain, trying to think about from a de-risking perspective of what does a network of keys look like? What's a real network of custodians? It's not just like eggs in one basket, but baskets tied together through key sharing, key management solutions. So that's the future we're hopeful for. While it's still always hard, like commercially, it's hard to grow that ecosystem in a sustainable way.
Yeah. Are you worried about like potential Coinbase? I wouldn't call it like centralization of Bitcoin, but just like their massive amounts of holdings, right?
Yeah.
Just because of all of that.
Yeah. They would have to be, anyone would have to be, you got to credit them for doing a tremendous job and they probably will continue to do a great job, but it's also just really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is really hard. Yeah. I mean, cause like, I think, with the ETFs and everything, I wouldn't be surprised if they have like over a million coins under
there. No, I think publicly probably like more and a half.
Yeah. Which is absolutely insane, but it's interesting that they didn't put any Bitcoin on their own balance sheet as, they've been in the industry for so long, but that's a separate matter. But, when it comes to running like a Bitcoin business, I feel like in the past, a big narrative was there was a lot of red tape to get through because of regulations and everything like that. Now it seems like, states around the country and with the strategic reserve and everything like that, people are becoming more friendly. Are you noticing that as well?
I think there's some vibes there. I mean, recounting like when we started in 2016, that the thing that took 6 months and felt like beating your head against the wall was just getting a simple bank account. Run on which to run the kind of dollar based flows or press at the time lending activities that we'd had. So that challenge, I think we thought, or is easier. There are more banks to kind of work with. And as much as that market has also ebbed and flowed, it does look even better. And that's part of it. It's not there's a direct influence from, because we don't even have the new administration yet. there's just a, there's those couple layers that, well, for now, those people at the top or in the most centralized clusters of power in DC, the influence there, the kind of fear, fear-inducing, you know, stances and policies and letters and intonations, that that's kind of going away. And the people that wrote those things or took that stance are going away. And so now the layers of, you know, career regulators and people that kind of report to them or from those are the bosses, now they no longer get that pressure. I do think a lot of the people on the ground or inside of the various offices for the Federal Reserve or FDIC, kind of regional regulators, that those people are good people doing their job, but they're also doing their job with, you know, they want to operate outside of like the fear of losing it. So if it look like, you know, allow this stuff to happen on the banks on your watch and you're going to cause issues for your higher ups, like that's going to result in the kind of pressure, soft and hard pressure you saw over the last few years on the banks working with our industry. So it's not going to happen like exactly overnight, but as you just kind of unwind that type of pressure, it will mean it's going to be easier to transact as a compliant firm.
Yeah. So, you know, on that, the U.S. Treasury recently released a report, a 26-page report through a lot of stuff, right? I mean, they went through stablecoin growth, Bitcoin growth, all that kind of stuff. But they mentioned that Bitcoin can be looked at as digital gold. Mm-hmm. Now, so I think that is pretty monumental with everything going forward. Just that they're kind of at the first step, so to speak, I think, where they're looking at it as a store of value opposed to, you know, the peer-to-peer transaction cash. Do you think where we're like maybe in our lifetime that we'll get towards the hyper Bitcoinization in the United States? Or do you think that we're going to kind of, I guess, keep it as this store of value sort of mindset here for quite some time?
I mean, gosh, it's so hard to predict that stuff. You know, you have to thread the multiple outcomes there of, yeah, like hyper Bitcoinization when the dollar is non-existent, or the spectrum of hyper-Bitcoinization where it's adopted by everyone as savings and dollars are adopted by everyone as spending. So it's at least the odds way to play it is like as a hybrid. And I think Bitcoin has real utilities that store value. I love this line. It was Peter St. Onge, one of our other partners who I'd heard on our podcast, The Bitcoin Frontier, which was like, yeah, the biggest value or the biggest thing gold is now is the way to explain Bitcoin to boomers, or kind of like that's its role in finance almost now as it sort of sunsets on its, you know, 10,000-year legacy. And that's it. You know, and that's the kind of a thing I think that it's like, is it, because again, gold is a proxy for something for people. Gold is a proxy of like, okay, lasting enduring value. And then for more in the people, even in the know that know more monetary history, it's like, oh, it's a proxy for things with this kind of stock to flow characteristics that, create scarcity, or it's, you know, what used to back currencies. But like for a lot of people growing up, I mean, my experience, at least as a teenager, was like, that stuff just sounded crazy to me. That sounded abstract. That sounded like, you know, like the gold bug. It's rare to find gold bugs that were in their 20s. You know what I mean? Like gold was that you tended to be older, tended to like be like kind of crustier. You know, not to say, I mean, there's been great spokespersons for it and stuff like that. It's not the winning message. But Bitcoin, because it's digital, it's like, I think for a lot of millennials, they don't need the digital gold analogy. It's just you need the, like, yeah, the digital scarcity, like the digital money, like money for the internet, kind of that's what pulls people in based on like the more the pre-existing concepts that are already in their head. Whereas like, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if like in 100 years or 50 years, maybe 10, that digital gold isn't even the relevant analogy anymore, because like, by then, people will have just forgotten about gold, or you know, or it will just be relegated to like pure industrial use. That I think that would be pretty neat.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life,
configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at the Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we're kind of trending that way. I think El Salvador like found like $3 trillion worth of unmined gold, or allegedly, you know, they found that they like fairly recently. So I think it's definitely trending in that direction. But you mentioned, you know, kind of your start into Bitcoin, where it was like in 2013 and, you know, you made your first exit and that's how you kind of got into Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Do you think kind of going through that 2008 crisis was, you know, part of the, obviously that's, you know, kind of the genesis of Bitcoin and when it came up, but seeing that and being a business owner going through that, do you think that that kind of helped you, I guess, understand Bitcoin right away? Just cause you were in the weeds, you saw inflation, massive amounts of money printing. Cause it seems like that's what brought a lot of people along in 2020.
No. Again, I think it was like I was pulled in by something like the technology narrative, and then it was more just of a novice when it came to more like finance and as really like an operator to that your business operator role there. I was focused on the business, like, and that's as far as part of the truth of startups is like you can't even the bear markets of Bitcoin, you have to be able to shut out other things going on and just focus on what you can control inside your business. And so, whether it was Lehman Brothers or whether it was some other bank or these, you know, these things happening in that great financial crisis, I was just pretty clueless, if I'm honest, and really focused what was right in front of me.
Yeah. So because I don't want to date you too much, but I believe you were graduating college around 08. Is that correct?
I was in college, but I was a college dropout.
So okay.
I left and shortly thereafter started that first business.
Okay.
So I didn't finish school. Came here to UT originally for college.
Yeah. So how did you see this being different from 2008 to 2020? Obviously, you know, we had everything shut down, but like, just like the economics of everything, like, have you noticed a drastic change? Do you think see things as similar? Do you see things now kind of as, you know, I guess maybe 2011 ish where we're starting to come out of it? Or do you like, how are you viewing this overall economic situation?
I think, I don't have a lot of comparators in an absolute sense. I'd say where I think I'm wiser and what I try to pay attention to is the flows of things.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, because a lot of themes while we're talking about is like the, you know, static versus dynamic systems and like the economy, the flows, the money system is, it's supremely dynamic. It's a lot of market actors exerting influence and everybody responding to everybody kind of at the same time. And like, because I think what was really crisp there of like what you got to experience in the 2020 and 21 cycle, what I felt kind of real time there was something like the Cantillon effect. Like you just watched as, okay, 2020, that financial crisis happened. Fed opens like other lending programs. It's discount window. All these mechanisms to like get money out. But that, you know, other than like the stimulus checks we got as individuals, most of that money went to like just near neighbor central financial institutions. And then those institutions, in many cases, look like pension funds or, you know, firms that then invest in venture capital and make commits to venture capital. So a lot of venture capital funds get, you know, stood up and funded or close their funds in early 21 on the heels of that. And then they're allocating to startups. And so, you know, Startup on Chain got its Series A in 21. And a lot of startups, like, you kind of got to watch that play out. Again, that is that flow of like the money kind of trickles through the system. And then we do talk about things like inflation or CPI or like, you know, we're just watching like what a ribeye, you know, goes for today versus 2 years ago. Friend Parker Lewis has good Twitter good tracking on that. So I guess just I think that I'm just kind of more aware of like watching that flow and like where I live in that. And that's similar in the same way you watch the diffusion of any technology or the diffusion of Bitcoin through these markets. It's more an awareness thing. Sometimes it's a transacting thing. The money flowing certain ways, but that's where I'm aware again, like, what does it look like when a system halts in some financial crisis where nobody transacts, nobody moves, nobody's willing to kind of commit that flow. It can be very halting when that happens too.
Yeah. Do you look at, any of the, I guess, governmental release data or anything along those lines just to, Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's to humor yourself maybe or anything like that, but you know, just to kind of track on what the way things are going, and how do you, I guess, your viewpoint on just governmental data in general?
I think it's all, you know, I think even in business, it gets this way with certain things of like it, you can't just treat the number as absolute because there's often so much that goes into it. And you could quibble with the way it's inaccurate on this dimension or a different one. And yet, you know, the ROI or what you, the utility of, to get a yet more perfect reflection of all the subcomponents and things that add up to it, it's not always there after a certain level. So what you just need is a stable comparator, thing that's always apples to apples. It's an imperfect measurement at the time, but over a time series, as long as the standard of measurement was the same, you at least do get that trend, or you do at least get that like derivative understanding of like, oh, is it moving up, down, or is it accelerating, decelerating? So that's probably how I treat most like government data. Will not at all be an expert on like how they have in fact probably tweaked CPI over time, or like, you know, change the definition of these things so that it becomes less relevant.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, to me, it just always seems like it becomes more and more manipulated from like the sense of what I'm feeling, and just kind of, yeah, like going to the grocery store and everything like that. It's like reporting that inflation's basically done, and you know, we're still, I feel like, still over a very high number. I always like to look at this website called govflation.com, where it shows basically how the CPI was calculated in 1982 compared to how it's calculated now. And I think like the last time I saw it in August, it was like 2.5% here is what the government reported. And if you looked at the basket of goods relative to 1982, it was like 10.3%. So this print came in at 2.7 or 2.9 or something like that, I think, this past month. So probably still around over 10% from relative to how we used to calculate it. But, you know, you mentioned coming here in 2008. I grew up here in Austin.
Oh,
so
nice.
I want to get into how you've seen Austin change a little bit since your time has been here. Because, yeah. I mean, it took off, right? I mean, 2020 has just been a massive inflow of people.
Yeah, really. I think it's, I was born in Anchorage, Alaska. I met some people from Austin. They made it sound really cool. When I was looking for schools to go to, I wanted a place that was warm and had a big university with a lot of resources. And then, you know, something business, right? You know, I'm going to start a company or be an entrepreneur. So something, some kind of location had a good business climate. And I can remember, yeah, getting to Austin in 2007 and seeing that there were four or five cranes downtown building something. And I was like, well, that, you know, people are making long-term investments here. Maybe there's something here. And then since then, there's been at least four or five cranes downtown, maybe up to 8 to 10 at times. I think also some of that same phenomena, though, of like where watching how the money flows. And Austin has it always like something like an investment case for commercial real estate due to the population growth, the influx of people, especially the demographics of who moves to Austin. And then like I live downtown. I was really fortunate this way. You know, I got a condo after I sold that business from 2013 to 20. I lived downtown. In summer of 20, I'd have my first kid. My wife and I needed to move out of downtown. It was also like into COVID, so downtown I was dead. And but before that, our building, like in the late 19 era, we'd sold the whole building as like ownership here in downtown. And like some developers came in, they're going to take that over because it's a great downtown corridor, like build something high. And that transaction closed, I remember, in February, you know, a month before the pandemic hits. And it was just like, gosh, what timing, you know, what luck we had. Just really on the front side of before everything fell off. And that poor developer, but like also, I think that's just in the cycles for these things that like that was a nice era. Developers like that could get financing, could, you know, get buildings, you know, buy plots with plans to develop for you know, good business cases that fell out. That building still hasn't been torn down, or I don't know that things have quite resurged for the real estate market here to make that investment case work. But I try not to complain. I mean, part of coming to Austin was a version of, yeah, I'm here because people are investing here. And so the like idea that like a bunch of people moved from California or friends from New York or people have moved in, I've enjoyed having been kind of something of an internet native denizen, or like something my career's been formed around a lot of networks I built on the internet, that all those people moved here. A lot of people that it used to be you'd have to live in New York to like have your network come to you. at any given time, just because people have business meetings or travel through that place once a year. But now in Austin, it's like, yeah, there's a conference here, there's an event there. Somebody that, you know, the long-term rider I expected moved here, things like that. So it's been nice to have folks that come.
What's up, y'all? Come and join me down here in Medellin by going to the Bitcoin Medellin conference. It's January 17th and 18th. You can use promo code GreenCandle21 for 21% off. That's a huge discount, folks. It'll be cheaper. Everything in Colombia is a little bit cheaper. You can come down, hang out with the Colombianos, those chicas, and have a little fun. We can party it up here down in Medellin. So come on and join the fun. Come in, hang out with me, Luke Mikich, Jeff Booth, some of the other great speakers here. All right. I will see you guys all in Medellin. Back to the show.
To you.
Yeah. Are you a University of Texas football fan?
I like it. I'm not a
you're not an avid fan.
I'm not like an active follower of it. I think it's cool, but
yeah.
I just don't get to
Yeah, that's how I feel like that's how like a lot of people who went to the University of Texas are. They came here for Austin, and then, you know, football is just like kind of an added bonus. Yeah. I went to A&M, so I'm an arch rival here. You guys whipped our butt this year, but you know, maybe we'll have better luck next year. If you were to recommend one thing that people do when they come to Austin, as I don't know, maybe summertime when it's a little bit warmer than it is now, what would be that thing?
And part of it depends on the demographic, I find, especially when we have employees come or like partners, I like to steer them to the Comedy Mothership because it's right down the street. Just like, hey, you know, the Joe Rogan's saying that they pull in good guests, great acts. So that would be something to try to hit. But ironically, I think when people come as like families or when I bring like extended family, I go to San Antonio.
Like, really?
It's kind of like,
wow.
Well, just, I mean, Austin's a place to hang out. You can see the Capitol. There's been kind of some more things, but really for, I think, you know, I joke like my aunt is a sign reader, you know, you like go to like a park and there's a little plaque there. Oh, they'll go read the plaque or like,
yeah,
they'll understand the local history or like whose monument is this. And San Antonio's place is like more full of that. I do find it's crazy to go see the missions and the like architecture that's there where you're looking at like what looks like a European castle or is in fact like a European castle from the 1700s. Right here in Central Texas.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a mind trip there. So for at least, yeah, when I'm trying to do like family outings of like that classic aunt or grandma or somebody that like wants to go see things, like that's what we do.
All right. Favorite food in Austin?
Gosh. Favorite food.
Or maybe even restaurant, if you want to give one a shout out or anything like that. Like where are you hitting maybe once a month?
Well, I mean, I have kids, so we're always getting pizza. Eastern pies, man, Via 313 are good rotations at home. Restaurants, you know, I was having like a good date night at Red Ash here downtown. It's nice, man, that the mix of steak and like high quality Italian, kind of upscale Italian stuff, like that's really hard to beat.
Yeah. Okay. So then, outside of that, then favorite place to go grab a drink or a happy hour here?
Oh, my spot is like around the corner. Place in that hostel, the Firehouse Lounge. I love it. I mean, they usually play like good kind of rap, like hip hop music. That's kind of my genre.
Oh, who's your go-to?
Hey, man, MF Doom has always been my favorite artist.
Really?
So, tragic, we lost him like, the last couple of years. But, you know, since there's like mix of personality and like what talent he had, you know, there's a spectrum there. A lot of great acts. Like, you know, I have to love K-Dot and have to love, you know, certain people, but I did my Spotify rap this year, and like my number two song was the ASAP Rocky like Hijack is his song.
Yeah,
like that was really good.
Oh, nice. Yeah, there we go. All right, so the slogan in Austin is Keep Austin Weird. So what's the weirdest thing that you about the city of Austin that maybe the average person doesn't know about?
I think just I think so much of the good weirdness is like unfortunately, kind of in a lot of like the rearview mirror, there was like who's the guy, the homeless guy that was kind of like that Leslie.
Leslie. That he would like have the guitar, right, and like
he would always like a thong and just be downtown, like you know, shirtless and like
he ran for mayor like every year, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was a local gem. He was just, and so I think just like anything, you know, just knowing that's the kind of roots of Austin past. People like Matthew McConaughey, like they hang out here, they live here. Like Austin just got a vibe, man.
You know? Yeah.
So being open and like seeing where that comes through and threads with it.
All right. Well, Joe, you've been very generous with your time. Why don't you tell people where they can find out more about Unchained and more about you as well?
Great. Unchained and myself are on X, UnchainedCom, and at Joseph Kelly, and Unchained.com. You can email me, joe@unchained.com. Let me know if we can help.
Yeah, awesome stuff. Well, I'll put all that in the show notes. So, Joe, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here, and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.